Notice I said that before I hit record. All right.
Happy wife, happy life is how the saying goes.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, you know that.
Excuse me. Am I about to interrupt you, Professor? I just got a question. Is it going to be the like same exam? Multiple choice and two questions?
Yeah.
Okay.
Might not be the exact questions, but
it I know that, but I'm just wondering how it's going to be.
Yeah.
So.
Did I not take? I must not have taken attendance in last class.
No.
All right. Well, I screwed the attendance up. Dylan's here. All right. So I did get your exams done. Grades are posted. If you did not take the second exam, and there was a couple of you that did not take the second exam, I had to submit your midterm grades. I was supposed to do it yesterday, but I didn't do it till about noon today. So if you did not take the exam, I counted it for midterm purposes as a zero, and I averaged it with your first exam, so you probably got an F. But you can take it. If you did not, just gotta send me an email and let me know when you can do it. And the other thing is that I did go to town on this one because I noticed something that was very easily apparent and observable in the fact that some of you used AI to help you on the exam. Even though it states on my syllabus that AI is not to be used for this class. And of course, there's the college academic honesty policy. Some of you used AI, ChatGPT, or whatever, to make your essays and to help you answer the multiple choice. And again, how could I tell? Well, if you finish the exam in like 15 minutes and you got all the multiple choice right. It's like, duh. Leading it out for me. So, if you were one of the people that I believe cheated, I gave you a 60 on the second exam. I did not give you a zero. I did not report you to the dean, which is something I do have the ability to do. But instead, I believe in second chances. So if you did cheat, I gave you a 60, so you didn't fail. But you still have the other two exams in the paper to complete. But I will be watching you. And if you do it again on the third exam, I will report you to the dean. You'll fail the class, and you might get put on academic probation because the college doesn't take too kindly to cheating. If you've got a 60, you can send me an email, and I will give you a chance to take a physical exam if you don't think you cheat. I actually had a young man in my last class saying, no, I didn't cheat. I didn't cheat. Okay, well, I'm going to let him take a paper exam. I'll see how he does. We'll see how that works out. But it is what it is. So if you're one of the people who didn't take it, let's get it done before we go out on break. I can't change your midterm, though. Midterm grade's already in, so your midterm grade is what your midterm grade is. Apologize. So if you're on a team and you get in trouble with the coach, you say, I didn't take the exam, but I made it up. I'm good now. And I'll sign off on that. All right. So what do we got? Simple. We got Vietnam developing. France is gone. Ike is gone. JFK's in the White House. Diem is, well, being Diem. And we got problems going on because, kind of like what's going on with Ukraine today, you know, the United States pumping billions of dollars into this war that really has nothing to do with us other than global politics. So, if JFK was smart when he became president, he would have done what Trump has started doing. Basically saying, we're done. But JFK did not, because JFK was more of an academic. He wasn't a businessman. So what JFK did is he listened to his advisors. People were saying it was screwed up. People were telling him, we need to get boots on the ground. We need to take it over. And other people were saying, it's all good. Don't worry about it. It's fine. So ultimately, that's the reason where we left off last class was with the administration basically taking the middle path. We're going to spend a little more money. We're going to send more military advisors. We're going to give them more military equipment. But we're still not going to get engaged. We're not going to put American boots on the ground in combat situations. Why did we stick with it? Cold War. Cold War. This means nothing to you because none of you were alive. Cold War basically came to an end with Glasnost when the Soviet Union fell in the late 1980s and early 1990s. The Cold War was a bizarre time in world history in which the world was divided into two armed camps, us versus them. And the goal of us was to keep us free from them. And the goal of them was to kind of take over some of us. So they could be more. So no matter what was going on in the world, there was always the belief that Russia, China are involved. And if we back off, then Russia, China will win. And we can't let them win. But another interesting thing occurred that most analysis sometimes overlooks. Many of JFK's advisors wanted us to ratchet things up because we could use South Vietnam as like war games. Essentially, we could use it as a testing ground for our ability to train up a native army and our ability to basically pump money into their economy and our ability to basically kind of become like puppet masters. And if we could concede there, could be successful, other nations would want our help and wouldn't walk away on us. That also meant that if we failed, it's going to be a huge black eye. It would undermine our credibility. It would undermine our international position. And it could actually trigger politics in America of who's responsible for the loss. Case in point, I don't know if any of you are politically minded, but if you were paying attention to the presidential election of last year, there was constant talk about how Biden basically embarrassed the United States when he bumbled our withdrawal from Afghanistan. That still, I heard about it talked about over the weekend. I was listening to a Talking Head radio show, and they brought it up again. JFK didn't want to have that happen. He didn't want to lose Vietnam on his watch. Because if a Democrat president fumbled, that could be an electoral win for the Republicans. So obviously this means it's complicated. Partisanship, parties. Why did Eisenhower win the 1952 election? Well, the Republicans blamed Truman for losing China. And in the midterm election of 1950 and the presidential election of 1952, it was a GOP sweep. And I hate to break it to you, parties do not make decisions for the American people. The Republicans and the Democrats, they only make decisions that's good for them. They want their people in charge. They want their people in power. So they will often intentionally ignore problems, hoping not to get blamed. And JFK's administration was not perfect. They did make mistakes. If you know anything about the Bay of Pigs, it was a huge embarrassment. What happened in Laos, that fell apart. That was an embarrassment. In reaction to how weak the United States looked, the Soviets built the Berlin Wall. And they began sending ICBMs to Cuba, which would give rise to the Cuban Missile Crisis. By the way, when I was your age and I was an undergrad, a very interesting piece about the Cuban Missile Crisis became declassified that nobody in the world knew. The Soviet general that was in Cuba had full command control over the nukes. And he was told by Moscow that if a single American boot lands in Cuba, fire nuclear missiles at the United States. We were this close to not being here because the world would have been annihilated before even I was born. So this was a dangerous time. And Kennedy flubbed up a bunch of things. So when you put all that in, it's no wonder why the administration essentially felt trapped. They were in a lose-lose situation, and there was nothing they could do about it. Because if they screwed it up, they would lose the elections. The Republicans would take Congress. Kennedy would be a one-term president. So we got involved for the wrong reasons. Questions? Now, one of the most amazing things is that by 1961, there were reporters in South Vietnam. And they began covering what was going on in Vietnam and sending it back to American newspapers. Stories that had not been present when Eisenhower was president. Because when Eisenhower was president, the French still controlled Vietnam. One of the most telling situations, which was physical proof of what the administration was doing, came with a single photograph. In December 1961, a reporter for the Associated Press by the name of Malcolm Brown was sitting on the terrace of a hotel in the middle of Saigon. And he looks out to the river and he sees an American carrier. He quickly raced out of the hotel, hooked up with one of his buddies who had a small helicopter, took him up in the air, and they started flying overhead. And he began taking some pictures. To his amazement, that carrier, which is the USS Core, C-O-R-E, had on its deck 47 helicopters. They were H-21 Shawnee helicopters, commonly known as the Flying Bananas. You'll start seeing pictures of them. Oh, there's one right there. They were called the Flying Banana because they kind of look like a banana. But in addition to the 47 helicopters, there also was a crew of over 400 men. Because we weren't going to teach the ARVN how to fly the helicopters, no. They would be American pilots flying those helicopters. And they were stamped with American symbols. Funding also increased. In the 1962 budget, JFK increased funding for the ARVN from $28.4 million to $144 million. And that's their money. I didn't scale it up for inflation.
and even more Americans were coming. In 1961, there were only about 2,000 American advisors. By the end of 1962, that increased up to 11,000. And the impact was noticed right out of the gates. You started seeing more and more American helicopters flying overhead in South Vietnam. They began airlifting equipment back and forth. They began making forward bases of operation. And on board the helicopters, there are ARVN soldiers, but when they were deployed, they all had embedded in them American advisors. So American soldiers began going into the jungles, advising the ARVN on how to kill the VC. And these units had air support. American planes deployed from carriers began flying inland operations, dropping napalm bombs. Napalm is nasty. It's a flammable jelly that sticks to everything, and you can't wash it off. So if you're a human being and you get it on you, it will basically burn through all of your skin and muscle down to your bone. And in addition to dropping napalm bombs on suspected VC locations, they also began crop dusting, using defoliants. Classified operation known as Operation Ranchand. Areas where there was suspected VC activity, these planes would fly overhead and basically spray defoliant. Like we'd be gone. Land on the leaves of the trees and the plants and just kill it. The goal was to get rid of the cover of the trees and to kill any crops. MAG also was upgraded. MAG, the Military Advisory and Assistant Group, was upgraded to MACV, the Military Assistance Command Vietnam. Whereas the operations for MAG was to advise and to make sure that the ARVN uses our equipment right, MACV, well, their job was to be embedded, to actually be advisors in the combat situations. MACV's first commander was a ball buster, Lieutenant General Paul D. Harkins. He was in charge of making U.S. policy in Vietnam. He was in charge of basically putting forth operations. And soon, MACV controlled security. They started bringing in U.S. contractors and saw the training and equipping of all military and paramilitary operations. In other words, the Vietnamese officers would have to report to him. Well, as these changes were implemented, the administration started saying, okay, maybe we can basically stabilize things. We don't need to escalate. Maybe we can get this war over quickly. Maybe we can actually crush the VC. Why did the president feel this way? Well, in May 1962, Secretary of State McNamara, sorry, Secretary of Defense McNamara, traveled to Vietnam for the first time. Instead of going and meeting with Diem, he traveled abroad. He talked to the MACV advisors. He talked to the South Vietnamese officers. He went out into the countryside, traveled the roads, talked to people. And he had press conferences so it would get reported back to America. In fact, after one meeting, this meeting, when he was out in a village and he talked to a local, McNamara actually said, and I quote, that he saw a great deal of positive things in South Vietnam and he had a good feeling for how things were going. He also said he saw nothing but progress and hopeful indications of further progress in the future. In other words, he was saying, we're winning. Well, this story gets into the newspapers, get reported back home, and the American people are like, okay, all right, maybe this is a good investment of our treasure. Because if we're going to win, that means when we win, we're done and we can stop. The problem was that when stories like this came home, everything was going so good that there was no chance of losing. Actually being defeated by these guerrillas, you know, was inconceivable. Because after all, you play sports, you're on a team, you have a great game, you absolutely crushed it. It was perfect, and that great game was preceded by a great week of practice in which you absolutely crushed it, and that good week was based upon the preceding game, which you did okay, but you understood what you did wrong, so you improved it in practice, and you brought your A game in the game, and you had crushed it. Well, what's going to happen in the next game? Does that necessarily mean you're going to be successful? Well, if you get cocky, what happens? The one thing that the Americans overlooked was the administration, what Diem was doing. Sure, if you go out to some random village and you talk to one random villager who's saying life is peachy keen, are you actually figuring out what's going on in the country? What was not discussed in the newspaper was the regime's launching of what is known as the Strategic Hamlet Program. Up Chien Lok, the Strategic Hamlet Program. What the Strategic Hamlet Program was a massive expansion of the Agroville Program. Agroville was started in 1959, we talked about it. It was where you take the villages from a village and you put them basically in a defended, armed village. Well, Diem abandoned it because by 1961, the peasants were resisting. They didn't want to leave their houses. They want to lose their fields. But Diem reports how the people loved it to the American advisors. And the American advisors are like, well, if the people love it, why don't we expand it? So with American funding, they began making villages that were the size of towns. And it would be guarded by U.S. trained soldiers. Because with U.S. money, Jim could build these massive structures. But what really was motivating Diem was the belief that if you could control the peasants and cut them off from the VC, we're going to be out in the country. And if the VC tried getting to the peasants, we can find them. Because in theory, the peasants will be safe. It's actually a cartoon that was written in a Vietnamese newspaper. See, look, you got the ARVN, and they help the nice peasant, and they keep them safe and protected, and then this loyal peasant will help kill the VC. Because they'll be happy. But, unfortunately, the strategic program never really did what it was supposed to do, because the VC were already embedded into the peasant population. So what would happen is a VC cadre man would basically go to the hamlet with the rest of the people and would rile them up. And that would lead to full-blown strikes and resistance movements and sometimes literally breakouts. So, the United States thinks we're winning, but all Diem is doing is just angering his people off. Angering his people off, that makes no sense. Pissing his people off, that would have made more sense. Questions? Why did it go so bad? Well, Diem put his brother Nu in charge. And Nu, if you remember, was kind of like pro-fascist. Nu had dreams. He fantasized about basically convincing the peasants to start a counter-revolution. That they would embrace the Hamlet program. That they would serve as soldiers to fight the VC. But even though Nu, racially, was Vietnamese, he didn't spend much time in Vietnam. He spent most of his time in France. He was French educated. He was Catholic. Yeah, he was the same race as the people of his brother's country. But he had nothing in common with them. So, he didn't go talk to them and see if they liked what was going on. No, he just focused on numbers. How many thousands of people have we moved? How many hundreds of these hamlets have we built? That's great. That's awesome. Numbers. I can take any data set and I can make it represent what I want it to make. But if you're only looking at the numbers, you're going to be happy no matter what. So, that's one of the reasons why he would launch what became known as Operation Sunrise. This was the first strategic hamlet that was built. It was a model camp. It would be like, you ever see like a new development going in? And usually right at the front of the development, they have a model house. So that way anyone looking to buy a house could go and check it out. Well, Operation Sunshine would be the model camp that the Americans could go in and take a look at. And they could see how clean it was, how it had running water, and it had, like, sewerage systems, and there was, like, trash pickup, and there would be restaurants. You know, it would be a nice little wonderful village. It had schools, it had houses, it had churches. Heck, the United States even ponied up $21 per family to help compensate if they lost their homes. When the hamlet was made, Diem moved in 210 families. But the irony was, is out of those 210, 140 of them were moved at gunpoint. The soldiers literally went to the peasant's home, marched him out under threat of death. So, would you be happy if a soldier showed up to your house and said, "We got a new place for you to live. By the way, if you don't come now, I'm going to shoot you." Well, with American money, New moved quickly. In September of 1962, he would announce to the Vietnamese people that he planned on relocating 4.3 million peasants, which was roughly one-third of the entire population of South Vietnam, to these new hamlets. And then, as the program began going, he revised his numbers. He increased them to 8.5 million. Which was two-thirds of the entire population of the country. But the problem is, he's announcing these numbers, but they're not based on reality. Why? Well, here are the fields. You can't move the fields because this is where the food's grown. So the peasants maybe used to live here. But now, you're going to move them way over here down the road. Because over here, they're going to be safe. But now, instead of walking out of their houses and going into the fields, they now have to go mile, 2, 5, 10, 20 miles down the road to get to the fields. How happy do you think they're going to be when they get there? And then what are the chances of people from the NLF intercepting them along the way, saying, "Hey, are you down with this? Do you like this? Do you support this? Join us. We'll overthrow Diem. You can go back to your village." Plus, the peasants were charged rents. So, they make what little money they can by harvesting their crops from their fields. They gotta sell it and then pay the man. Before, they didn't make a lot of money, but at least they were making something. Now they're literally not making anything. And lastly, Diem's agents or news agents were corrupt. They stole from the peasants. They embezzled money. And corruption ran rampant. So, JFK is getting word that everything's going great. The American people believes that the war is almost over. But the one thing they don't understand is that what is happening is gas is being spread on the fields, and it's only a matter of it being lit. Question. So, you have a powder keg. You have more of a commitment. You have more American soldiers, and the American soldiers are going out into the field. What happens if VC is hiding in this tree and takes a pop shot at the ARVN soldier? Well, he could hit the American advisor in the back of the head. What happens if this volunteer is actually an embedded VC? Sure, he's learning how to fire a Garand. What's going to stop him from turning and shooting the advisor in the head? The more we were engaged, the more contact we had, the more opportunity was there for bad things to occur. But here's the funny thing. Even those who were embedded became engaged. They wanted to win. Because unlike the attitudes of many of our politicians for the last 30, 40 years, back in 1960, Americans won wars. With the exception of Korea. That was kind of like a neutral draw, but that really wasn't an American war. Well, we won World War II. We won World War I. We won the Spanish-American War. We won the Civil War. We win. So these advisors are there figuring out the war, and they're like, yeah, we can win it. One of the most influential of MACV's advisors was Lieutenant Colonel John Paul Van. Van arrived in Vietnam in March of 1962. He was a 37-year career soldier. He fought in Korea. Van, like many other U.S. advisors, knew nothing about Vietnamese history. They knew nothing about Vietnamese culture. They didn't understand Ho Chi Minh. They didn't understand nationalist movements that dated all the way back to the colonial period under the French. But Van liked war. And while he didn't take the time to learn about the Vietnamese people, he was eager to get the war so we could win. So, his first operation, May 1962, he was with a convoy that traveled 35 miles south of Saigon to a village of Mai Thau. There he hooked up with the 7th Infantry Division of the ARVN. The 7th Infantry Division was in charge of protecting the northern half of the Mekong Delta. Well, Van's there, riding in the armored personnel carriers, observing the ARVN soldiers, and it suddenly dawned on him that the ARVN soldiers don't actually want to fight. If you take the oath and you join the military, you join not hoping to go into combat, but if you get called on, you are ready to fight and kill the enemy to achieve victory. Well, these Vietnamese soldiers were just like, yeah, we get to wear a uniform. It looks nice. I like my boots. They're comfortable. He also realized that the moment the VC opened fire, the ARVN soldiers and the officers choose not to fight. But the moment they hear one, boom, they get in their vehicles and they begin driving away. So on his first travel in and around Vietnam, he concludes to his superior officers, he reports, the VC are going to win. The VC are going to win because the South Vietnamese soldiers are not there to protect the people.
the national labor front is.
So the VC are going to win because the VC has the sympathy of the peasants. Well, his superior officer told him, well, Lieutenant Colonel, get him to fight. So, his job then was to convince the commanding officer of the 7th Infantry Division, Colonel Hu Van Cao, to actually fight, to be more aggressive, to use tactics to win. They argued, they debated, but eventually Van convinces Cao to be more aggressive. Because after all, as he pointed out, who are the VC? They're a bunch of people running around in black pajamas in the jungles. But look at what the United States is giving to you. The Viet Cong, they have their rifles. Most of it is surplus rifles that date back to World War II. Yeah, they have some machine guns, but many of the machine guns they have date back to World War I. Most of what they had is the junk that the Russians and the Chinese sold to them. Although I'll say this much. This soldier right there is charging in with an SKS, and I have one of those. That's a great battle rifle. But what does the U.S. give them? Ho, ho, ho. Game-changing technology. The United States are bringing in helicopters. Unlike the French, who had to move their soldiers on the roads that could be booby-trapped or destroyed or attacked from either side of the jungles, with the Americans, we can airlift ARVN. Men, munitions, equipment, anywhere in country. This basically means that the ARVN has access to all of South Vietnam. Although ironically, what they didn't realize is that most VC bases were not more than 20 miles away from any ARVN bases. Because once the ARVN made a base, the VC moved in to be in close proximity. So they weren't that far to go. The U.S. was also deploying spy planes, utilizing electronic intelligence that could pick up radio communication. By the 1960s, this equipment, which was developed in World War II, you had the ability to triangulate the location of any signal that was sent out within a half-mile radius. So if Charlie's on the radio and he's calling into base and you pick up on that, you got a pretty good idea where they are. You deploy the helicopters. You move the men. Oh, and the United States also sent over M113 armored personnel carriers. So unlike the French who had to move guys in trucks, thanks to the United States' help, the ARVN could show up in armored personnel carriers. So even if the VC engage in guerrilla strikes from the roadside, they're still going to be safe. And these 10-ton vehicles were also amphibious. They could float.
And on top, 50-caliber machine gun.
The bullet from a 50-caliber round is about, well, actually, it's about two markers long. It's about how big one round is. And this top part is the actual bullet that comes off the casing. This would basically make your body go like a watermelon hitting it with a sledgehammer.
And air support.
By 1962, the United States began moving over the first jets, including the F-105 Thunder Chief. State of the art, top speed, Mach 2.8 times the speed of sound. They were armed with 20mm M61A1 Vulcan guns, which is like a Gatling gun. And they could carry a payload up to 14,000 pounds of munitions. They had the ability to bomb the bejeebus out of anything. And there was no plane in 1962 that the Russians had that could outmaneuver, outrace the Thunder Chiefs. So, you put all this together and you have shock and awe. And when it was operating, 1962, the VC didn't know what to do about this. They had never seen anything like it. This right here is just one napalm bomb. It would drop down and hit the ground and it would spray napalm 200 feet. One plane had the ability to blow up entire villages. This photograph was taken of a bunch of ARVN soldiers that got radioed to move away from the village. Why send your boys in and get shot doing house to house? Two Thunder Chiefs came in and basically blew the whole village up. So, Van is telling Cal, look, we can basically wipe out the enemy if your guys fight. So Van basically sees all these Vietnamese soldiers in American uniforms. He's told they are all trained up by MACV operatives. They are organized in units and squadrons and divisions. He's absolutely convinced, well, if they look the part, they'll play the part, that they will actually fight like an American fighting force. They will fight to win. But the problem is you can put lipstick on a pig. It doesn't make the pig a hottie. The pig is still a pig. So the one thing that Van didn't realize was that the ARVN, like the war itself, was not American in nature. The Army of the Republic of Vietnam was shaped by Vietnamese politics, by Vietnamese history. And even though they look like Americans, they didn't think, they didn't act, they didn't fight like Americans. Case in point. Colonel Cowell. Here he is, dressed in his finest. He's got American-produced battle maps. He is talking about moving units, telling his officers what is going to be the operations of the day, just like an American officer. But the problem is how he got the job. He didn't earn his position. He didn't start off as a private, and he didn't work his way up through the ranks. He got the job because he was Catholic. And he was from a family that gave lots of money to Diem. So, he gets the job not because of what he can do, but because who he is and what he knows, or who he knows. Plus, he has to obey Diem. And Diem's only concern was that his army, like I told you before, was going to be like his toys. His little G.I. Joe soldiers. So Diem was constantly worried about a coup d'etat. So guess what Cao was worried about? Whether or not the regime was going to get overthrown. Because if the regime got overthrown, he'd be out of a job. So essentially, he was a political appointee. He was not a fighting man. So he's supposed to be the leader of the 7th Division to lead his men in the battlefield to win. He doesn't know a thing about war. And do you think he wants to die? Hell no. He was not a leader who led from the front. He was the leader who led from behind at the base, yelling orders on a walkie-talkie. So Van soon concluded that the commanding officer of this 7th Division, which he was embedded with, is actually not interested in fighting the VC. In Van's report to his superior, he said he urged Cao to send out night patrols. Because that's when the VC does most of their movement. Cao responded, it's not safe to go out at night. Van urged him to train his men for combat. Cao responded, there's no need. It's just the VC. Van urged him to treat captured VC as soldiers of, or rather prisoners of war. Cao responded, why? They're the enemy. So in his report to Mac V, after being with Cao for 5 months, Van states the following. It's only a matter of time before the VC learn not to panic and how to fight the ARVN more skillfully. Because when that occurs, the ARVN will not be able to resist. And by the way, unbeknownst to Van, the VC were learning. Every single time the ARVN would deploy, go out, engage, and then retreat, the VC would go back to the battlefield. And they would study what took place. They would interview witnesses. And soon they began adapting, finding the weaknesses in what the ARVN was doing. And they began killing more of them. Which, of course, outraged Diem. So what does Diem do? Because as I told you before, he literally had walkie-talkies to all of the commanders of all of the units. Diem contacted Cao personally and basically said, if you want to get promoted, you got to bring your casualties down. So how did Cao respond to that? Cut back on operations. If you don't want soldiers dying, you don't send them out in the field, which means you give the land to the enemy. So what ends up happening? Cow becomes trained, conditioned. He only does something when DM's pleased, is displeased. And when DM's displeased, they don't fix the problem. You do everything you can to hide the problem so it doesn't go away.
Questions?
Now's the time for the slap in the face. The game changer. When everything I just talked about fell into place.
The Battle of Uppbach. On January 2nd, 1963. Thanks to American reconnaissance, they catch electronic chatter suggesting that the VC are located at a small village called Uppbach, which was 40 miles southwest of Saigon. The 7th Infantry Division would locate an estimated 350-man battalion of VC in the village. So, we found the enemy. Let's deploy the 7th Infantry. Well, Cow doesn't lead the men. But the commander that's going to go out with the men is Colonel Bui Dinh Dam. Bui Dinh Dam is Cao's chief of staff. He, like Cao, was only an officer because he was promoted by DM.
Van, while planning the operation, actually has a map. That's a map of Uppbach. And he's sitting there trying to talk to him, saying, look, this is where we know the enemy are located. This is what we need to do. We need to move in the armor of personnel characters. We'll airlift men in. We'll provide air cover.
But you got to engage in what's called a set-piece battle. Meaning, if the enemy is here, you need to move in your manpower with air cover and basically strike the enemy where they are. You don't go and hope they come out after you. You attack the enemy where they are and you blow them up. You kill them all. Well, Dom replies, no. When we come, VC runs away. And Van's like, no, they're going to fight back. But Dom knew the VC more than Van did.
But after much talking and much talking and much talking, Dom finally says, okay, we go fight.
Unfortunately for Dom, the VC commander, Vo Van Dieu, had been ordered by his commanding officers to stay and fight, to actually dig in and fight back from a fixed position. So, take a step back. Vance says, move the men in and fight from where you are and strike the enemy position. Dam believes, no, we just run in, VC run away. But the VC are digging in and they're going to fight back. Which means the moment the 7th Infantry starts charging, thinking the VC's going to run away, they're going to get mowed down. Now, we don't know much about Dieu, but we know Dieu was a veteran of the Viet Minh's fight against the French. We also know that he was at the Battle of Bien Dam Phu. So he actually had combat experience. He knew how to lead his men in the fight. And his group had been studying the American tools of war. They saw the armored personnel. They saw how the helicopters fly in, the patterns that they have to take. They understood how long an helicopter would remain on the ground so all the soldiers could disembark before it could take off, how quickly it could take off, what angles does it fly. They were observing everything. So, what do they decide to do? Well, when the map comes up, we're going to see there was a big field, and along the edges of the field were a bunch of hedgerows. These hedgerows, these dams and dikes, overlook the rice paddies. So, in other words, they artificially get the high ground. And they have sweeping fire over the whole field, which they knew the ARVN would come right into. And man, did the ARVN come. 1,400 men. Oh, there's the village. So there we go. There's our field. There's the dikes and the earthen positions. This is what the VC dig into. They have full sweeping fire over the field itself. So, 1,400 men are going to be moved in. Most are going to be deployed by helicopter. The Flying Bananas. The original plan called for using 30 helicopters to basically move the bulk of the army in quick. But only 10 were available. So that meant the men had to come in waves. Which meant helicopters come in, fly down low, disembark, gonna have to fly 40 miles back to base, load up again, come back. How much time does that take? In addition to the Flying Bananas, there were also other support vehicles, including a UH-1, which we're going to know become known as the Huey helicopters. The Hueys were gunships, armed with heavy machine guns and rockets. So, the helicopters come into the rice paddy, lowers down, drops the men out. The men are in the wide open, and they are supposed to basically advance to the tree lines, not knowing that's where the VC are. In other words, they're going to charge right at the enemy. So, when the first wave comes in, the VC open fire. 5 of the 15 helicopters are shot down, including the gunship. The men who were actually deployed by the helicopters, they completely panic. They freeze. They basically lay down in the middle of the rice paddies. These are actual pictures, by the way, of the battle. They're not accustomed to having the VC not run away. They're not accustomed to basically being shot at. So they lie down on the ground and refuse to move. Because they're not going to die. Well, while all shit's hitting the fan, Van's flying overhead in an L-19 reconnaissance plane, shouting over the radio to the officers, basically saying, your men are sitting ducks, get them to move. And all he's hearing back is that the soldiers are refusing. They're disobeying orders. So now they're trapped literally in the middle of the field. So Van comes in, Van calls in 13 APCs to come in to hope to lay down suppressing fire to basically rescue the men trapped in the middle of the battlefield. But,
oh, this picture's down, too bad.
The VC had sharpshooters. They knew that in order for the gunner to fire the machine gun, he had to actually climb out of the compartment. And he was completely exposed from the waist up. So what do? You wait for the gunner to come up, and you sit there, and you sit there, and you sit there, and the moment you see him, pow, you shoot him dead. You know the other thing that they knew?
You can't see it from this picture, because that's the back. You can actually see it from these ones.
But the driver, it was a slope front, and there was an elevated roof, and the driver's head was here. A good bullet. Nice shot. You could kill the driver. And if you kill the gunner and you kill the driver, where's the APC gonna go?
This one actually had three of them that had been stuck in the mud, but I screwed up the placement.
As the day went on, gunner's dead, driver's dead, soldiers are getting sniped at in the middle of the field. The VC continued to lay down suppressing fire until the sun set. Then the moment the sun set, the VC slipped away. Back into the jungles from whence they came. Now, the Battle of Akpok is monumental because the VC did something that was unthinkable, inconceivable. They defeated, gave a tactical, fixed position defeat to this American trained force. The ARVN would have 86 of their soldiers killed in action, and another 108 wounded. But this was the first major battle when Americans lost their lives. And it got reported in American newspapers. Right there. The young man on the top left. That's Army Specialist Donald Bremen. He was 21 years old. He was in one of the Shawnee, the Flying Bananas, and was hit by machine gun fire. The Shawnee crashed and he was injured, but they couldn't get him out of the helicopter. So he ended up bleeding to death, strapped in the crashed helicopter. Next to him, Sergeant William Deal. He was 35. Deal was a crew chief on the Huey gunship. His job was not to fly the plane. His job was to sit in the back seat and was basically a door gunner. Well, as the Huey entered the battle zone, The VC peppered it with machine gun fire, some of which hit the engines, the helicopter's engine, and it crashed to the ground. While the pilot and the co-pilot managed to get out, Sergeant Deal, he became dislodged in the compartment, and he was basically squished to death. And the last man down on the bottom, Captain Kenneth Good, he was an ARVN advisor. He landed with the men. Shortly after they disembarked from the Flying Banana, he was hit in the shoulder with a bullet, trying to convince the ARVN not to drop to the ground where they are, but to get, find a defensive position, and fire back. Well, he ended up dying of blood loss. He would actually be evac'd, but he had lost so much blood by the time they got him off the battlefield, he ended up dying in a hospital. FYI, these three men, their names are on the wall down in DC. They're on the first panel. Row 13, Brahmin. Row 14, Deal and Good. As far as the VC go, 18 killed, 39 wounded. But what's amazing was not only how many of the ARVN they killed, but what their position was hit with. 600 rounds of artillery, there were napalm bombs that were released by 13 warplanes that flew overhead. Plus another 5 Huey gunships came in. They pounded the position. But the VC knew they would do that, so you know what they did? They dug underground. So the moment the American aircraft came in, they simply went down into the bunkers. Boom, big bombs hit, they fly away, then they would come back out. The unthinkable. All right, wrap this up real quick. Abbach basically revealed to those who were paying attention that the war was not on the verge of ending like McNamara told JFK. Instead, it showed that the ARVN was incompetent. That even though they were being trained up by Americans, the ARVN fighters were not Americans and were unwilling to fight and die like Americans. And it also revealed that the ARVN would not obey the orders of the Americans. U.S. could only advise. Actually, because of the time, we're not going to go late. We'll finish up with my conclusion of Abbach when we come back. And then after we do that, we're going to look to... Oh my God, another international crisis that would be instigated by Diem. And if we're lucky, we'll have regime change, although I won't keep you late on Thursday because it's the class before spring break. All right, so everyone was here at the beginning, right? So you got my spiel on the exam and the midterm?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. All right, guys. Yeah. See you on Thursday.